The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, concluded. Cassette 15, Side 2. A similar stratagem had been repeatedly practiced by the ancients. The Ottoman galleys, I must again repeat, should be considered as large boats. And if we compare the magnitude and the distance, the obstacles and the means, the boasted miracle has perhaps been equaled by the industry of our own times. As soon as Mohammed had occupied the upper harbour with a fleet and army, he constructed in the narrowest part a bridge, or rather mole, of 50 cubits in breadth and 100 in length. It was formed of casks and hogsheads, joined with rafters, linked with iron, and covered with a solid floor. On this floating battery he planted one of his largest cannon, while the 40 galleys, with troops and scaling ladders, approached the most accessible side, which had formerly been stormed by the Latin conquerors. The indolence of the Christians has been accused for not destroying these unfinished works, but their fire, by a superior fire, was controlled and silenced. Nor were they wanting in a nocturnal attempt to burn the vessels as well as the bridge of the Sultan. His vigilance prevented their approach. Their foremost galliots were sunk or taken. 40 youths, the bravest of Italy and Greece, were inhumanly massacred at his command. Nor could the emperor's grief be assuaged by the just, though cruel, retaliation of exposing from the walls the heads of 260 Mussulman captives. After a siege of 40 days, the fate of Constantinople could no longer be averted. The diminutive garrison was exhausted by a double attack. The fortifications, which had stood for ages against hostile violence, were dismantled on all sides by the Ottoman cannon. Many breaches were opened, and near the gate of St. Romanus, 4 towers had been levelled with the ground. For the payment of his feeble and mutinous troops, Constantine was compelled to despoil the churches with the promise of a fourfold restitution. And his sacrilege offered a new reproach to the enemies of the Union. A spirit of discord impaired the remnant of the Christian strength. The Genoese and Venetian auxiliaries asserted the preeminence of their respective service, and Justiniani and the great duke, whose ambition was not extinguished by the common danger, accused each other of treachery and cowardice. During the siege of Constantinople, the words of peace and capitulation had been sometimes pronounced, and several embassies had passed between the camp and the city. The Greek emperor was humbled by adversity, and would have yielded to any terms compatible with religion and royalty. The Turkish Sultan was desirous of sparing the blood of his soldiers, still more desirous of securing for his own use the Byzantine treasures. And he accomplished a sacred duty in presenting to the Gabours the choice of circumcision, of tribute, or of death. The avarice of Mohammed might have been satisfied with an annual sum of 100,000 ducats, but his ambition grasped the capital of the East. To the prince he offered a rich equivalent, to the people a free toleration or a safe departure. But after some fruitless treaty, he declared his resolution of finding either a throne or a grave under the walls of Constantinople. A sense of honour and the fear of universal reproach forbade Palaiologos to resign the city into the hands of the Ottomans, and he determined to abide the last extremities of war. Several days were employed by the Sultan in the preparations of the assault, and a respite was granted by his favourite science of astrology, which had fixed on the 29th of May as the fortunate and fatal hour. On the evening of the 27th, he issued his final orders, assembled in his presence the military chiefs, and dispersed his herald through the camp to proclaim the duty and the motives of the perilous enterprise. Fear is the first principle of a despotic government, and his menaces were expressed in the Oriental style, that the fugitives and deserters, had they the wings of a bird, should not escape from his inexorable justice. The greatest part of his Beyshaws and Janissaries were the offspring of Christian parents, but the glories of the Turkish name were perpetuated by successive adoption. And in the gradual change of individuals, the spirit of a legion, a regiment, or an oda is kept alive by imitation and discipline. In this holy warfare, the Muslims were exhorted to purify their minds with prayer, their bodies with 7 ablutions, and to abstain from food till the close of the ensuing day. A crowd of dervishes visited the tents to instill the desire of martyrdom and the assurance of spending an immortal youth amidst the rivers and gardens of paradise, and in the embraces of the black-eyed virgins. Yet Muhammad principally trusted to the efficacy of temporal and visible rewards. A double pay was promised to the victorious troops. "The city and the buildings," said Muhammad, "are mine, but I resign to your valor the captives and the spoil, the treasures of gold and beauty. Be rich and be happy. Many are the provinces of my empire. The intrepid soldier who first ascends the walls of Constantinople shall be rewarded with the government of the fairest and most wealthy. And my gratitude shall accumulate his honors and fortunes above the measure of his own hopes." Such various and potent motives diffused among the Turks a general ardor, regardless of life and impatient for action. The camp re-echoed with the Muslim shouts of, "God is God, there is but one God, and Muhammad is the apostle of God." And the sea and land, from Galata to the Seven Towers, were illuminated by the blaze of their nocturnal fires. Far different was the state of the Christians, who with loud and impotent complaints deplored the guilt or the punishment of their sins. The celestial image of the Virgin had been exposed in solemn procession, but their divine patroness was deaf to their entreaties. They accused the obstinacy of the emperor for refusing a timely surrender, anticipated the horrors of their fate, and sighed for the repose and security of Turkish servitude. The noblest of the Greeks and the bravest of the allies were summoned to the palace to prepare them, on the evening of the 28th, for the duties and dangers of the general assault. The last speech of Palaiologus was the funeral oration of the Roman Empire. He promised, he conjured, and he vainly attempted to infuse the hope which was extinguished in his own mind. In this world, all was comfortless and gloomy, and neither the gospel nor the church have proposed any conspicuous recompense to the heroes who fall in the service of their country. But the example of their prince and the confinement of a siege had armed these warriors with the courage of despair, and the pathetic scene is described by the feelings of the historian Franza, who was himself present at this mournful assembly. They wept, they embraced. Regardless of their families and fortunes, they devoted their lives, and each commander, departing to his station, maintained all night a vigilant and anxious watch on the rampart. The emperor and some faithful companions entered the dome of St. Sophia, which in a few hours was to be converted into a mosque, and devoutly received with tears and prayers the sacrament of the Holy Communion. He reposed some moments in the palace, which resounded with cries and lamentations, solicited the pardon of all whom he might have injured, and mounted on horseback to visit the guards and explore the motions of the enemy. The distress and fall of the last Constantine are more glorious than the long prosperity of the Byzantine Caesars. In the confusion of darkness, an assailant may sometimes succeed, but in this great and general attack, the military judgment and astrological knowledge of Muhammad advised him to expect the morning, the memorable 29th of May, in the 1453rd year of the Christian era. The preceding night had been strenuously employed. The troops, the cannon, and the fascines were advanced to the edge of the ditch, which in many parts presented a smooth and level passage to the breach. And his 40 galleys almost touched, with the prows and their scaling ladders, the less defensible walls of the harbour. Under pain of death, silence was enjoined, but the physical laws of motion and sound are not obedient to discipline or fear. Each individual might suppress his voice and measure his footsteps, but the march and labour of thousands must inevitably produce a strange confusion of dissonant clamours, which reached the ears of the watchmen of the towers. At daybreak, without the customary signal of the morning gun, the Turks assaulted the city by sea and land, and the similitude of a twined or twisted thread has been applied to the closeness and continuity of their line of attack. The foremost ranks consisted of the refuse of the host, a voluntary crowd who fought without order or command, of the feebleness of age or childhood, of peasants and vagrants, and of all who had joined the camp in the blind hope of plunder and martyrdom. The common impulse drove them onwards to the wall. The most audacious to climb were instantly precipitated, and not a dart, Not a bullet of the Christians was idly wasted on the accumulated throng. But their strength and ammunition were exhausted in this laborious defence. The ditch was filled with the bodies of the slain. They supported the footsteps of their companions, and of this devoted vanguard the death was more serviceable than the life. Under their respective bayshores and sanjaks, the troops of Anatolia and Romania were successively led to the charge. Their progress was various and doubtful, but after a conflict of 2 hours the Greeks still maintained and improved their advantage. And the voice of the emperor was heard, encouraging his soldiers to achieve, by a last effort, the deliverance of their country. In that fatal moment the Janizaries arose, fresh, vigorous, and invincible. The sultan himself, on horseback, with an iron mace in his hand, was the spectator and judge of their valour. He was surrounded by 10,000 of his domestic troops, whom he reserved for the decisive occasion, and the tide of battle was directed and impelled by his voice and eye. His numerous ministers of justice were posted behind the line, to urge, to restrain, and to punish, and if danger was in the front, shame and inevitable death were in the rear of the fugitives. The cries of fear and of pain were drowned in the martial music of drums, trumpets, and atterballs, and experience has proved that the mechanical operation of sounds, by quickening the circulation of the blood and spirits, will act on the human machine more forcibly than the eloquence of reason and honour. From the lines, the galleys, and the bridge, the Ottoman artillery thundered on all sides, and the camp and city, the Greeks and the Turks, were involved in a cloud of smoke which could only be dispelled by the final deliverance or destruction of the Roman Empire. The single combats of the heroes of history or fable amuse our fancy and engage our affections. The skilful evolutions of war may inform the mind and improve a necessary, though pernicious, science. But in the uniform and odious pictures of a general assault, all is blood and horror and confusion, nor shall I strive, at the distance of 3 centuries and 1,000 miles, to delineate a scene of which there could be no spectators, and of which the actors themselves were incapable of forming any just or adequate idea. The immediate loss of Constantinople may be ascribed to the bullet or arrow which pierced the gauntlet of John Justiniani. The sight of his blood, and the exquisite pain, appalled the courage of the chief, whose arms and counsels were the firmest rampart of the city. As he withdrew from his station in quest of a surgeon, his flight was perceived and stopped by the indefatigable emperor. "Your wound," exclaimed Palaiologus, "is slight. The danger is pressing. Your presence is necessary. And whither will you retire?" "I will retire," said the trembling Genoese, "by the same road which God has opened to the Turks." And at these words he hastily passed through one of the breaches of the inner wall. By this pusillanimous act he stained the honours of a military life, and the few days which he survived in Galata, or the Isle of Chios, were embittered by his own and the public reproach. His example was imitated by the greatest part of the Latin auxiliaries, and the defence began to slacken when the attack was pressed with redoubled vigour. The number of the Ottomans was 50. Perhaps 100 times superior to that of the Christians. The double walls were reduced by the cannon to a heap of ruins. In a circuit of several miles, some places must be found more easy of access or more feebly guarded, and if the besiegers could penetrate in a single point, the whole city was irrecoverably lost. The first who deserved the Sultan's reward was Hassan the Janissary, of gigantic stature and strength. With his scimitar in one hand, and his buckler in the other, he ascended the outward fortification. Of the 30 Janissaries who were emulous of his valour, 18 perished in the bold adventure. Hassan and his 12 companions had reached the summit. The giant was precipitated from the rampart. He rose on one knee and was again oppressed by a shower of darts and stones. But his success had proved that the achievement was possible. The walls and towers were instantly covered with a swarm of Turks, and the Greeks, now driven from the vantage ground, were overwhelmed by increasing multitudes. Amidst these multitudes the emperor, who accomplished all the duties of a general and a soldier, was long seen and finally lost. The nobles who fought round his person sustained till their last breath the honourable names of Palaiologus and Cantacuzene, His mournful exclamation was heard, "Cannot there be found a Christian to cut off my head?" And his last fear was that of falling alive into the hands of the infidels. The prudent despair of Constantine cast away the purple. Amidst the tumult, he fell by an unknown hand, and his body was buried under a mountain of the slain. After his death, resistance and order were no more. The Greeks fled towards the city, and many were pressed and stifled in the narrow pass of the gate of St. Romanus. The victorious Turks rushed through the breaches of the inner wall, and as they advanced into the streets they were soon joined by their brethren, who had forced the gate Fenar on the side of the harbour. In the first heat of the pursuit about 2,000 Christians were put to the sword, but avarice soon prevailed over cruelty, and the victors acknowledged that they should immediately have given quarter if the valour of the emperor and his chosen bands had not prepared them for a similar opposition in every part of the capital. It was thus, after a siege of 53 days, that Constantinople, which had defied the power of Chosroes, the Chagan, and the Caliphs, was irretrievably subdued by the arms of Mahomet II. Her empire only had been subverted by the Latins. Her religion was trampled in the dust by the Muslim conquerors. The tidings of misfortune fly with a rapid wing, yet such was the extent of Constantinople that the more distant quarters might prolong some moments the happy ignorance of their ruin. But in the general consternation, in the feelings of selfish or social anxiety, in the tumult and thunder of the assault, a sleepless night and morning must have elapsed. Nor can I believe that many Grecian ladies were awakened by the Janissaries from a sound and tranquil slumber. On the assurance of the public calamity, the houses and convents were instantly deserted, and the trembling inhabitants flocked together in the streets, like a herd of timid animals, as if accumulated weakness could be productive of strength, or in the vain hope that amid the crowd each individual might be safe and invisible. From every part of the capital they flowed into the church of St. Sophia. In the space of an hour, the sanctuary, the choir, the nave, the upper and lower galleries, were filled with the multitudes of fathers and husbands, of women and children, of priests, monks, and religious virgins. The doors were barred on the inside, and they sought protection from the sacred dome, which they had so lately abhorred as a profane and polluted edifice. Their confidence was founded on the prophecy of an enthusiast or impostor, that one day the Turks would enter Constantinople, and pursue the Romans as far as the Column of Constantine, in the square before St. Sophia, but that this would be the term of their calamities, that an angel would descend from heaven with a sword in his hand, and would deliver the empire, with that celestial weapon, to a poor man seated at the foot of the column. "Take this sword," would he say, "and avenge the people of the Lord." At these animating words, the Turks would instantly fly, and the victorious Romans would drive them from the west, and from all Anatolia, as far as the frontiers of Persia. It is on this occasion that Ducas, with some fancy and much truth, upbraids the discord and obstinacy of the Greeks. "Had that angel appeared," exclaims the historian, "had he offered to exterminate your foes if you would consent to the union of the church, even then, in that fatal moment, you would have rejected your safety or have deceived your God?" While they expected the descent of the tardy angel, the doors were broken with axes, and as the Turks encountered no resistance, their bloodless hands were employed in selecting and securing the multitude of their prisoners. Youth, beauty, and the appearance of wealth attracted their choice, and the right of property was decided among themselves by a prior seizure, by personal strength, and by the authority of command. In the space of an hour, the male captives were bound with cords, the females with their veils and girdles. The senators were linked with their slaves, the prelates with the porters of the church, and young men of a plebeian class with noble maids, whose faces had been invisible to the sun and their nearest kindred. In this common captivity the ranks of society were confounded, the ties of nature were cut asunder, and the inexorable soldier was careless of the father's groans, the tears of the mother, and the lamentations of the children. The loudest in their wailing were the nuns, who were torn from the altar with naked bosoms, outstretched hands, and dishevelled hair, and we should piously believe that few could be tempted to prefer the vigils of the harem to those of the monastery. Of these unfortunate Greeks, of these domestic animals, whole strings were rudely driven through the streets, and as the conquerors were eager to return for more prey, their trembling pace was quickened with menaces and blows. At the same hour, a similar rapine was exercised in all the churches and monasteries, in all the palaces and habitations of the capital. Nor could any place, however sacred or sequestered, protect the persons or the property of the Greeks. Above 60,000 of this devoted people were transported from the city to the camp and fleet, exchanged or sold according to the caprice or interest of their masters, and dispersed in remote servitude through the provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Among these we may notice some remarkable characters. The historian Franzer, first chamberlain and principal secretary, was involved with his family in the common lot. After suffering 4 months the hardships of slavery, he recovered his freedom. In the ensuing winter, he ventured to Adrianople and ransomed his wife from the Mirbashi, or master of the horse. But his 2 children, in the flower of youth and beauty, had been seized for the use of Mohammed himself. The daughter of Franza died in the seraglio, perhaps a virgin. His son, in the 15th year of his age, preferred death to infamy, and was stabbed by the hand of the royal lover. A deed thus inhuman cannot surely be expiated by the taste and liberality with which he released a Grecian matron and her 2 daughters, on receiving a Latin ode from Philelphus, who had chosen a wife in that noble family. The pride or cruelty of Mohammed would have been most sensibly gratified by the capture of a Roman legate, but the dexterity of Cardinal Isidore eluded the search, and he escaped from Galata in a plebeian habit. The chain and entrance of the outward harbour was still occupied by the Italian ships of merchandise and war. They had signalized their valour in the siege. They embraced the moment of retreat, while the Turkish mariners were dissipated in the pillage of the city. When they hoisted sail, the beach was covered with a suppliant and lamentable crowd, but the means of transportation were scanty. The Venetians and Genoese selected their countrymen, and notwithstanding the fairest promises of the Sultan, the inhabitants of Galata evacuated their houses and embarked with their most precious effects. In the fall and the sack of great cities, an historian is condemned to repeat the tale of uniform calamity. The same effects must be produced by the same passions, and when those passions may be indulged without control, small, alas, is the difference between civilized and savage man. Amidst the vague exclamations of bigotry and hatred, the Turks are not accused of a wanton or immoderate effusion of Christian blood, but according to their maxims, the maxims of antiquity, the lives of the vanquished were forfeited. And the legitimate reward of the conqueror was derived from the service, the sale, or the ransom of his captives of both sexes. The wealth of Constantinople had been granted by the Sultan to his victorious troops, and the rapine of an hour is more productive than the industry of years. But as no regular division was attempted of the spoil, the respective shares were not determined by merit, and the rewards of valour were stolen away by the followers of the camp, who had declined the toil and danger of the battle. The narrative of their depredations could not afford either amusement or instruction. The total amount in the last poverty of the empire has been valued at 4 millions of ducats, and of this sum a small part was the property of the Venetians, the Genoese, the Florentines, and the merchants of Ancona. Of these foreigners, the stock was improved in quick and perpetual circulation, but the riches of the Greeks were displayed in the idle ostentation of palaces and wardrobes, or deeply buried in treasures of ingots and old coin, lest it should be demanded at their hands for the defence of their country. The profanation and plunder of the monasteries and churches excited the most tragic complaints. The dome of St. Sophia itself, the earthly heaven, the second firmament, the vehicle of the cherubim, the throne of the glory of God, was despoiled of the oblations of ages, and the gold and silver, the pearls and jewels, The vases and sacerdotal ornaments were most wickedly converted to the service of mankind. After the divine images had been stripped of all that could be valuable to a profane eye, the canvas or the wood was torn, or broken, or burned, or trod underfoot, or applied in the stables or the kitchen to the vilest uses. The example of sacrilege was imitated, however, from the Latin conquerors of Constantinople, and the treatment which Christ, the Virgin, and the saints had sustained from the guilty Catholic might be inflicted by the zealous Mussulman on the monuments of idolatry. Perhaps instead of joining the public clamour, a philosopher will observe that in the decline of the arts, the workmanship could not be more valuable than the work, and that a fresh supply of visions and miracles would speedily be renewed by the craft of the priest and the credulity of the people. He will more seriously deplore the loss of the Byzantine libraries, which were destroyed or scattered in the general confusion. 120,000 manuscripts are said to have disappeared. 10 volumes might be purchased for a single ducat. And the same ignominious price, too high perhaps for a shelf of theology, included the whole works of Aristotle and Homer, the noblest productions of the science and literature of ancient Greece. We may reflect with pleasure that an inestimable portion of our classic treasures was safely deposited in Italy, and that the mechanics of a German town had invented an art which derides the havoc of time and barbarism. From the first hour of the memorable 29th of May, disorder and rapine prevailed in Constantinople till the 8th hour of the same day, when the Sultan himself passed in triumph through the gate of St. Romanus. He was attended by his viziers, bashaws, and guards, each of whom, says a Byzantine historian, was robust as Hercules, dexterous as Apollo, and equal in battle to any 10 of the race of ordinary mortals. The conqueror gazed with satisfaction and wonder on the strange, though splendid, appearance of the domes and palaces, so dissimilar from the style of Oriental architecture. In the Hippodrome, or at Maidan, his eye was attracted by the twisted column of the three serpents, and as a trial of his strength, he shattered with his iron mace, or battle-axe, the under jaw of one of these monsters, which in the eyes of the Turks were the idols or talismans of the city. At the principal door of St. Sophia, he alighted from his horse and entered the dome, and such was his jealous regard for that monument of his glory that, on observing a zealous Mussulman in the act of breaking the marble pavement, he admonished him with his scimitar that if the spoil and captives were granted to the soldiers, the public and private buildings had been reserved for the prince. By his command, the metropolis of the Eastern Church was transformed into a mosque. The rich and portable instruments of superstition had been removed, the crosses were thrown down, and the walls, which were covered with images and mosaics, were washed and purified and restored to a state of naked simplicity. On the same day, or on the ensuing Friday, the muezzin, or crier, ascended the most lofty turret and proclaimed the ezan, or public invitation, in the name of God and his prophet. The imam preached, and Mohammed II performed the namaz of prayer and thanksgiving on the great altar where the Christian mysteries had so lately been celebrated before the last of the Caesars. From St. Sophia, he proceeded to the august but desolate mansion of 100 successors of the great Constantine, but which in a few hours had been stripped of the pomp of royalty. A melancholy reflection on the vicissitudes of human greatness forced itself on his mind, and he repeated an elegant distich of Persian poetry. The spider has wove his web in the imperial palace, and the owl hath sung her watch-song on the towers of Afrasiab. 4. The ruins of Rome in the 15th century, and conclusion of the whole work. In the last days of Pope Eugenius IV, two of his servants, the learned Poggius and a friend, ascended the Capitoline Hill, reposed themselves among the ruins of columns and temples, and viewed from that commanding spot the wide and various prospect of desolation. The place and the object gave ample scope for moralizing on the vicissitudes of fortune, which spares neither man nor the proudest of his works, which buries empires and cities in a common grave. And it was agreed that, in proportion to her former greatness, the fall of Rome was the more awful and deplorable. Her primeval state, such as she might appear in a remote age, when Evander entertained the stranger of Troy, has been delineated by the fancy of Virgil. This Tarpeian rock was then a savage and solitary thicket. In the time of the poet, it was crowned with the golden roofs of a temple. The temple is overthrown, the gold has been pillaged, the wheel of fortune has accomplished her revolution, and the sacred ground is again disfigured with thorns and brambles. The hill of the capital, on which we sit, was formerly the head of the Roman Empire, the citadel of the earth, the terror of kings, illustrated by the footsteps of so many triumphs, enriched with the spoils and tributes of so many nations. This spectacle of the world, how is it fallen? How changed? How defaced? The path of victory is obliterated by vines, and the benches of the senators are concealed by a dunghill. Cast your eyes on the Palatine Hill and seek among the shapeless and enormous fragments the marble theatre, the obelisks, the colossal statues, the porticoes of Nero's palace. Survey the other hills of the city, the vacant spaces interrupted only by ruins and gardens. The forum of the Roman people, where they assemble to enact their laws and elect their magistrates, is now enclosed for the cultivation of pot herbs, or thrown open for the reception of swine and buffaloes. The public and private edifices that were founded for eternity lie prostrate, naked, and broken, like the limbs of a mighty giant. And the ruin is the more visible from the stupendous relics that have survived the injuries of time and fortune. When Petrarch first gratified his eyes with a view of those monuments, whose scattered fragments so far surpass the most eloquent descriptions, he was astonished at the supine indifference of the Romans themselves. He was humbled, rather than elated, by the discovery that, except his friend Rienzi and one of the Colonna, a stranger of the Rhone was more conversant with these antiquities than the nobles and natives of the metropolis. The ignorance and credulity of the Romans are elaborately displayed in the old survey of the city, which was composed about the beginning of the 13th century. And without dwelling on the manifold errors of name and place, the legend of the Capitol may provoke a smile of contempt and indignation. The Capitol, says the anonymous writer, is so named as being the head of the world, where the consuls and senators formerly resided for the government of the city and the globe. The strong and lofty walls were covered with glass and gold, and crowned with a roof of the richest and most curious carving. Below the citadel stood a palace, of gold for the greatest part, decorated with precious stones, and whose value might be esteemed at one-third of the world itself. The statutes of all the provinces were arranged in order, each with a small bell suspended from its neck, and such was the contrivance of art magic, that if the province rebelled against Rome, the statue turned round to that quarter of the heavens. The bell rang, the prophet of the Capitol reported the prodigy, and the Senate was admonished of the impending danger. A second example, of less importance, though of equal absurdity, may be drawn from the two marble horses led by two naked youths, which have since been transported from the baths of Constantine to the Quirinal Hill. The groundless application of the names of Phidias and Praxiteles may perhaps be excused, but these Grecian sculptures should not have been removed above 400 years from the age of Pericles to that of Tiberius. They should not have been transformed into two philosophers or magicians, whose nakedness was the symbol of truth and knowledge, who revealed to the emperor his most secret actions, and after refusing all pecuniary recompense, solicited the honour of leaving this eternal monument of themselves. Thus, awake to the power of magic, the Romans were insensible to the beauties of art. No more than 5 statues were visible to the eyes of Poggius, and of the multitudes which chance or design had buried under the ruins, the resurrection was fortunately delayed till a safer and more enlightened age. The Nile, which now adorns the Vatican, had been explored by some labourers in digging a vineyard near the temple or convent of the Minerva. But the impatient proprietor, who was tormented by some visits of curiosity, restored the unprofitable marble to its former grave. The discovery of a statue of Pompey, 10 feet in length, was the occasion of a lawsuit. It had been found under a partition wall, The equitable judge had pronounced that the head should be separated from the body to satisfy the claims of the contiguous owners, and the sentence would have been executed if the intercession of a cardinal and the liberality of a pope had not rescued the Roman hero from the hands of his barbarous countrymen. But the clouds of barbarism were gradually dispelled, and the peaceful authority of Martin V and his successors restored the ornaments of the city, as well as the order of the ecclesiastical state. The improvements of Rome since the 15th century have not been the spontaneous produce of freedom and industry. The first and most natural root of a great city is the labour and populousness of the adjacent country, which supplies the materials of subsistence, of manufactures, and of foreign trade. But the greater part of the Campania of Rome is reduced to a dreary and desolate wilderness. The overgrown estates of the princes and the clergy are cultivated by the lazy hands of indigent and hopeless vassals, and the scanty harvests are confined or exported for the benefit of a monopoly. A second and more artificial cause of the growth of a metropolis is the residence of a monarch, the expense of a luxurious court, and the tributes of dependent provinces. These provinces and tributes had been lost in the fall of the empire, and if some streams of the silver of Peru and the gold of Brazil have been attracted by the Vatican, the revenues of the cardinals, the fees of office, the oblations of pilgrims and clients, and the remnant of ecclesiastical taxes afford a poor and precarious supply, which maintains, however, the idleness of the court and city. The population of Rome, far below the measure of the great capitals of Europe, does not exceed 170,000 inhabitants. And within the spacious enclosure of the walls, the largest portion of the seven hills is overspread with vineyards and ruins. The beauty and splendour of the modern city may be ascribed to the abuses of the government, to the influence of superstition. Each reign, the exceptions are rare, has been marked by the rapid elevation of a new family, enriched by the childless pontiff at the expense of the church and country. The palaces of these fortunate nephews are the most costly monuments of elegance and servitude. The perfect arts of architecture, painting, and sculpture have been prostituted in their service, and their galleries and gardens are decorated with the most precious works of antiquity, which taste or vanity has prompted them to collect. The ecclesiastical revenues were more decently employed by the popes themselves in the pomp of the Catholic worship. But it is superfluous to enumerate their pious foundations of altars, chapels, and churches, since these lesser stars are eclipsed by the sun of the Vatican, by the dome of St. Peter, the most glorious structure that ever has been applied to the use of religion. The fame of Julius II, Leo X, and Sixtus V is accompanied by the superior merit of Bramante and Fontana, of Raphael and Michelangelo. And the same munificence which had been displayed in palaces and temples was directed with equal zeal to revive and emulate the labours of antiquity. Prostrate obelisks were raised from the ground and erected in the most conspicuous places. Of the 11 aqueducts of the Caesars and consuls, 3 were restored. The artificial rivers were conducted over a long series of old or of new arches to discharge into marble basins a flood of salubrious and refreshing waters. And the spectator, impatient to ascend the steps of St. Peter's, is detained by a column of Egyptian granite, which rises between 2 lofty and perpetual fountains to the height of 120 feet. The map, the description, the monuments of ancient Rome have been elucidated by the diligence of the antiquarian and the student, and the footsteps of heroes, the relics not of superstition but of empire, are devoutly visited by a new race of pilgrims from the remote and once savage countries of the north. Of these pilgrims, and of every reader, the attention will be excited by a history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, the greatest, perhaps, and most awful scene in the history of mankind. The various causes and progressive effects are connected with many of the events most interesting in human annals. The artful policy of the Caesars, who long maintained the name and image of a free republic, the disorders of military despotism, the rise, establishment, and sects of Christianity, the foundation of Constantinople, the division of the monarchy, the invasion and settlements of the barbarians of Germany and Scythia, the institutions of the civil law, the character and religion of Mahomet, the temporal sovereignty of the popes, the restoration and decay of the Western Empire of Charlemagne, the crusades of the Latins in the East, the conquests of the Saracens and Turks, the ruin of the Greek Empire, the state and revolutions of Rome in the Middle Ages. The historian may applaud the importance and variety of his subject, but while he is conscious of his own imperfections, he must often accuse the deficiency of his materials. It was among the ruins of the Capitol that I first conceived the idea of a work which has amused and exercised near 20 years of my life, and which, however inadequate to my own wishes, I finally deliver to the curiosity and candour of the public. Lausanne, June the 27th, 1787. This concludes the reading of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. This book was read by David Case.